भद्रं कर्णेभिः शृणुयाम देवा भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ ओ गॉड्स मे वी हियर ऑस्पिशियस वर्ड्स विथ आवर इयर्स व्हाइल एंगेज्ड इन सैक्रिफाइसेस मे वी सी ऑस्पिशियस थिंग्स विथ आवर आईज व्हाइल प्रेजिंग द गॉड्स विथ स्टेडी लिम्स मे वी एंजॉय अ लाइफ That is beneficial to the gods. May Indra of ancient fame be auspicious to us. May the all-knowing Purusha, god of the earth, be propitious to us. May Garuda, the destroyer of evil, be well disposed towards us. May Brihaspati ensure our welfare. Om, peace, peace, peace. So, we are studying the Mundaka Upanishad, which has three sections, and we have made fairly good progress. We have completed two sections. We are on the three chapters, really. Each chapter has two sections. So we have completed two chapters, and we have started the third chapter, the first section of the third chapter. In this section, the subject is various practices necessary for enlightenment. Remember the background. The student goes to the teacher and asks, Sir, what is that by knowing which everything can be known? And the teacher said there are two kinds of knowledge. When knowing everything in detail, that's one kind, the lower kind of knowledge. But knowing the ultimate reality, Brahman, by knowing which you can know everything. So that constitutes enlightenment. And the goal of that would be, of course, freedom from samsara, freedom from suffering, attainment of fulfillment. In fact, attainment of the goal of life. Now, having said that, how do you become enlightened? How do you know that by knowing which everything is known? So for that, what is required? The discussions about the disciplines required. And we saw that a great deal of importance was given first and foremost to truth, satya, truth. And then austerity, which was described as self-control focus, the focus of the mind and the senses, attention, focus. Third was, there was an emphasis on celibacy, brahmacharya. And all of these nityam, constantly. Truth, constantly, consistently holding on to a truthful, integrated lifestyle. And then second is brahmacharya, that is celibacy, constantly. Third is focus, intense attentiveness to spiritual life, the teaching. And then the other means which was given, the direct means for enlightenment was knowledge. Samyak jnanena, I said knowledge. So I mentioned that there are these outer disciplines and the inner discipline. The inner discipline is knowledge to be gained by shravana, manana, nididhyasana, by constantly listening, studying, then reflecting upon what has been gathered in one's listening, and then meditating upon it. But the outer disciplines are very important. Without them, the inner discipline will not work. The outer disciplines are truth, austerity, that is focus or concentration, and celibacy. Of course, you can see that over time, when you come to Shankara Vedanta and post-Shankara Vedanta, thousands of years after this text, this is the Upanishads, but thousands of years afterwards, you will see the whole thing has been systematized. The fourfold qualifications, the discernment between the eternal and the non-eternal, the dispassion, vairagya, dispassion for the non-eternal, the six disciplines of control of the mind, shamaha, control of the body and the senses, dhamaha, titiksha, a spiritual fortitude, which will, you know, willing to go through ups and downs and difficulties in spiritual life. And then uparati, a withdrawal from unnecessary engagement with worldliness. And then samadhana, settling down, focus. Again, we find focus, settling down on this one thing only, that is the quest for enlightenment, the teaching. Then this shraddha, a faith, the foundation is that faith, what these texts say, what the teacher says, it is true. And therefore, I can hold on until I begin to understand and then I begin to realize it. In which case, it's not faith anymore. See, there's one point about faith. It starts with faith in the sense that you feel that there is something worthwhile here and worth pursuing. And then you hold on. You take the text seriously, you take the teacher seriously, and you hold on. But very soon, once clarity dawns, you begin to understand. We understand that this is, we understand what is being taught. And then it becomes a reality for us. Then it's not that the faith goes away. This is the point I'm making. It's not that the faith goes away as you move along. What happens is the faith gets transformed into what is called in Sanskrit nishtha or jnana nishtha. Staying with it. Your whole life becomes revolutionized and your whole life becomes based on that spiritual knowledge. That's the maturation of the faith. Then the last discipline would be intense desire for liberation. So this is what we saw last time. Now, we are going to mantra number 7. Mantra number 7. Let me chant it out first and then the translation. Brihachatad divyam achintya rupam sukshmachatad sukshmataram vibhati durat sudure tadihanti kecha pashyat suihaiva nihitam guhayam. I'll read out the translation by Swami Gambhiranandaji. It is great and self-effulgent, and its form is unthinkable. It is subtler than the subtle, it shines diversely. It is farther away than the far off, and it is near at hand in this body. Among sentient beings, it is perceived as seated in this very body in the cavity of the heart. All right. What's going on here? It's a kind of recapitulation. That ultimate reality by knowing which everything is known, that is being, again, we are being reminded of it. It's a very powerful and beautiful verse which talks about Brahman, the ultimate reality, our own reality, what we truly are. Each word has to be carefully considered. So, Brihat Chatad Divyam Achintya Rupam. Brihat means vast. That's the root from which Brahman comes, Brihat. Vast. Vast means limitless. Brahman, that ultimate reality, is that which other than which nothing else exists. So the entirety of this universe, space, time, all matter and energy, all living and non-living things, the galaxies and stars and galaxies, the massive cosmic scale, and the subatomic scale of tiny particles, all of that is nothing else but this ultimate reality, Brahman. Brihat, vast, means not limited by anything. It's not limited in space, and therefore it's everywhere. There's nothing, there is nowhere where it is not. It is not limited in time, which means there was never a time when it did not exist. There will never be a time when it will not exist, which means it is eternal. It is not limited by object. Now we have to be careful what that means. Limitation by object means, it's a peculiar concept but interesting, that each object is only identical to itself. Here is a book. This is a book. And this object is identical to itself as a book, but it's different from everything else. It's different from this person who's holding it. It's different from the table. This book is different from the computer. This book is in fact different from other books. In fact, this book is different from other copies of the same book. So each object is distinct, identical to itself, and different from everything else. Now, Brahman is such, no limitation. This is called object limitation, being identical to itself and distinct, separated from every other object. But Brahman has no object limitation, which means there is no object which is separate from Brahman, which is independent of Brahman, which is other than Brahman. Nothing other than Brahman. No second object other than Brahman. No second means non-dual, Advaitam. So Brihat, the word Brihat, vast, means it is all-pervasive, it is eternal, it is non-dual. What is the only thing that can be such? What is the only thing that we can conceive of, which is everywhere, which is eternal, which never goes away, and other than which there is no nothing. There can't be anything other than it. And the answer, of course, to this riddle, it sounds like a philosophical riddle, the answer is existence. Existence, isness, in Sanskrit, sat, sat. Being itself. What do I mean by being itself, existence, isness? Normally, we are used to existing things. The book is, the cloth is, man is, the woman is, space is. Even Harry Potter is in some fictional universe. So everything is pervaded by this isness. We don't give any attention to that is. We don't give any attention to that existence. But do give attention to that existence. Think of existence. Suppose, just as an experiment, conceive of existence as primary and the objects as names and forms of that existence. What I mean by that is, if you look at the ocean and you see this wave and that huge tsunami wave and this drop, this bubble, and so on. But if somebody points out they are all water, they're all water, the foam, the surf, and the bubble, and the small wave, and the huge wave, all of that is water. Similarly, I'm saying instead of water, say existence. And instead of waves and bubbles and foam, say everything in the universe. So existence is everywhere. Can there be anywhere? If there's only empty space, that also exists. Empty space exists. So existence is everywhere. Existence is eternal. Things come and go. Existing things are born and they die, produced and destroyed. But existence continues. If you are interested in this kind of thinking, I recommend Shankaracharya's commentary on the 16th verse of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Nasato vidyate bhava. That 16th verse of chapter 2, there's an extensive commentary by Shankaracharya which deals with this line of reasoning. So even when things are destroyed, existence is still there. A book is destroyed, pages exist. Book is torn apart. So book is, you cannot say anymore. But page is also torn apart. Paper is, if that also you pound into atomic level, atom is, subatomic particle is, isness continues. Or if this thing is destroyed, that thing, book is gone, but the table is. If somebody says all things are destroyed, all existing things are destroyed, Mahapralaya, the cosmic dissolution of the entire universe, then where is your precious existence? Where is your precious existence? We'll say existing things have been destroyed, but existence itself continues, except that it cannot be appreciated, it cannot be experienced, because no names and forms are there. What is production? Existence assuming a particular name and form. What is destruction? Existence losing that particular name and form. What is total destruction? Cosmic dissolution. Nothing remains in the universe anymore. Existence giving up every name and form. But existence is still there. So that's a line of thinking. It's called Brihat, the vast. Or another word is Sat. And this is the theme of the 6th chapter of Chandogya Upanishad. In another Upanishad, Chandogya Upanishad, which I hope we'll get to someday, the famous Upanishad where that thou art, Tattvamasi, comes from. There the teacher, who is the father, tells his son, before all of this universe, there was existence alone. Sadeva samya idamagra asit. Ekameva advitiyam, one only without a second. And then names and forms came. You know, then space and air and fire and water and earth came, and then these worlds came, and plants and animal bodies and all of that came. But existence alone was there. And when every name and form is removed, existence alone remains. In between what's there right now, existence alone is there. You say, but there are names and forms, right? But remember, those names and forms are also nothing other than existence. We agreed existence, the vast infinite means there is no second thing apart from existence. So if there are names and forms and activities, there are human beings and plants and animals and stars and quasars, such a tremendous variety of names and forms. Names, forms, and activities in Sanskrit, nama, rupa, vyavahara. And yet, in all of that, truly speaking, upon the final analysis, what is there is existence alone. Just as no matter a tremendous variety of waves and surf and foam and whatever is going on in the ocean, in the final analysis, there is water alone. Every bit of it is nothing other than water. Okay, so this is the meaning of brihat. Brihatya. Then it is not dull, dead existence. It shines. It's a shining existence. It says tad divyam. It shines as consciousness itself. It is self-revealed. So what is the nature of consciousness? It shines, revealing itself and illumining everything else. So existence is also consciousness. Tad divyam. Where is it consciousness? In us, we are, you are that. So the teacher tells the student in the Chandogya Upanishad, there was this only one existence alone, and you are that existence. But you are also consciousness, because that's how we experience ourselves. Look, we are a conscious being. We are conscious beings. We are aware. So this awareness, this consciousness, it is self-luminous, which means to know anything, we need that consciousness. That consciousness reveals everything. How does it reveal? By seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, by thinking, by, you know, science and art and religion. All of these are ways in which consciousness reveals things to us in this universe. But it's itself not revealed. It does not require another consciousness to reveal itself. Just like the light shines and illumines everything in a dark room. And to know that light, you don't need another light. Similarly, consciousness itself does not require another consciousness. It reveals itself and illumines everything else. This is called swaprakasha, technically, self-luminous. Here it is called, in Upanishadic language, tad divyam, that is self-luminous. Where is this self-luminous, limitless, vast existence? This self-luminous consciousness in Sanskrit, in Vedanta, is called chit, chit. Brihat, vast, is sat. This divyam is chit, self-luminous consciousness. But this self-luminous consciousness, which is also limitless existence, where is it? He says, achintya rupam. It is inconceivable. And by extension, it cannot be seen, heard, smelt, tasted. It cannot be thought of. It cannot be spoken of. So it's not an object of our thought, of our mind. It's not an object of our senses. It's not an object of our intellect. It's not an object of our language. How do I know it exists? If I can't see it, hear it, smell it, taste it, or touch it, if I cannot think about it, I cannot speak about it, then how do I know it exists? Because you are it, and you cannot doubt your own existence. And that's what the Advaita Vedanta wants to claim. So this is achintya rupam. Literally, it means it cannot be conceived of by the mind. That's what it means. And the real reason why it cannot be conceived of by the mind, there are two ways of understanding this. Why can it not be conceived of by the mind? The strict technical Advaitic reason is that it's not an object. The mind can only conceive of objects, can think, it can think about something. It can think about a concept, a place, an incident, an activity. But pure being itself, you cannot think about it. Try thinking about pure being. You cannot. You can think about an existing thing, but you can't think about existence itself. You can think about my example of the water in all the waves, but that's just an example. water is also a thing. So existence itself you cannot conceive of. Every time we try to think of existence itself, we'll think about some existing thing. Infinity, limitlessness, eternal, all-pervasive, and non-dual. Try to think of it, you can't. Self-luminous consciousness. Try to grasp what it is, we cannot. We can only grasp the objects presented to consciousness. We can only grasp the things illumined by consciousness, things which we are aware of. But that which makes us aware, our nature as consciousness, we cannot objectify it. Grasping means objectification. We can't object because it's not an object. And yet, just because we indubitably exist, we're indubitably having all these experiences, that's the proof that this is something real. This is not just some metaphysical speculation. Then, sukshmataram, it's subtler than the subtlest. This universe, this is a gross physical universe, but it's made of subtle elements, earth, and subtler than that is water, subtler than that is fire. This is old cosmology. Subtler than that is wind, subtler than that is the sky, akasha, space. But this is subtler than that also. Subtler than all the five elements out of which this entire universe is made is the three gunas, Maya. I'm talking in Vedantic cosmology. Maya, out of which the three gu these five elements were produced. That's subtler. Maya is subtler than the five elements. But subtler than Maya also is pure being, a pure consciousness. Sukshmat, sukshmataram, subtler than the subtlest. Shankaracharya says it is subtler than the subtlest as the cause of all. So the cause is subtler than the effect, and the entire universe is the effect, and Brahman is the cause. Remember, this way of thinking, it goes back to the very beginning of our discussion here. What is that one thing by knowing which everything can be known? What do you mean? How can you know everything by knowing one thing? You know everything in detail. How can you know one thing and then you can know everything else? You can, if you know the material cause out of which everything is made. If you understand what is clay, then you understand what all these pots are. If you understand what is water, then you understand what all these waves are. Not in detail, not in the details, but in essence, what they are, the reality of them. So similarly, if you understand the cause of the entire universe, the material cause of the entire universe, then by knowing that material cause, you know everything. That is the original logic. So it says, it's subtler than the subtlest, that material cause of the universe is subtler than everything else in the universe. So it is subtler than everything else because it is the cause of all. Of course, here's a little footnote to this. Really, Brahman is not the cause of anything. Because from an Advaita perspective, only Brahman exists. It's not that there is a cause and then an effect has been produced. Brahman alone was, is, and will be. When the whole universe is there, and Sadhu put it very beautifully, in the midst of the marketplace, in the midst of hundreds of people coming and going, and the dust and the noise of the marketplace, one alone non-dual existence consciousness, that is your Atman, exists. While you see everybody, while you talk with everybody, while you buy and sell, while you enjoy and suffer, there's always one non-dual consciousness shining forth. One non-dual existence that is appearing in all these ways. In the midst of the busyness of life, in the midst of the ups and downs, it does not mean that you have to extinguish life itself, that you have to extinguish all experience, then only that non-dual existence consciousness bliss is there. No, no, no. Right here. What is all this? Where will you find water? Once all the waves have calmed down, when all the drops have settled back into the ocean, then only it is water? No. In the midst of the most turbulent ocean, like a hurricane is going on, it's still exactly the same water. Oh, I forgot to mention one thing. When I said inconceivable by the mind, I said in two senses inconceivable. One sense I mentioned, the main point is that it is not an object. But there's also another sense in which it is inconceivable. Sri Ramakrishna says, no matter how high you soar, he says that no matter how high a bird flies, there are higher and higher regions still. No matter how intelligent we are, there's a limit to what we can grasp. Why should it be that the ultimate reality of this universe can actually be grasped by our limited minds? It's in fact much more reasonable to think that we cannot grasp that ultimate reality. So in that sense also it's achintya, that it is limitless, infinite, and therefore not graspable by our limited minds. So two senses, two ways of understanding why mind cannot understand that ultimate reality. One is, of course, the strict, direct sense in which it's not an object. Mind can only grasp an object, but it is not an object, and therefore you cannot grasp it. Another one is, another meaning is, because it is limitless, it is beyond the capacity of the limited mind to understand. No matter how high a bird flies, there are far higher regions still. So, for both of these reasons, Dura acha Vibhati shines. So did it not just say divyam, it shines? But here vibhati. Vibhati means vividam bhati. It shines variously. Shankaracharya will say, it shines as the sun and the moon and the stars. But we no, need not just extend the example of luminosity. It shines as everything in the universe, as this tremendous variety. It's that one non-dual reality shining as this tremendous variety of duality. One might ask, how can non-dual be dualistic or contradicting yourself in the same statement? Yes, it would be contradictory if I said a real non-duality is also a real duality. No. Real non-duality and an appearance of duality. Brahma Satyam, Jagat Mithya. Those two can go together. A dry desert and a mirage full of water, they can go together. A dry desert and a real oasis, it cannot go together. Either it's an oasis or it's a desert sand. The two cannot go together. So, real non-duality in the ultimate sense and an appearance of a universe of multiplicity can perfectly go together. In a dream, it could be only one dreamer, you. But in the dream, there can be 100 people, 1,000 people. There could be earth and sky and water and events happening, good and bad. All of it could be there without anything at all. It could just be one dreamer. Perfectly possible. Only if, in a dream, without going anywhere, you can go to Africa, India, Europe, wherever. In the dream, actually, you have not gone anywhere. That's possible because there is the difference between the waking and the dreaming. The waking person who has fallen asleep has not gone anywhere. And that's the reality. And that is perfectly compatible with the in the dream traveling across the world. But if you say directly, if you say both are true together, I did not go anywhere, I was lying on my bed, and I went to India, truly speaking, I went to India and came back, then the two are contradictory. It cannot be at the same time, same person cannot be traveling and not traveling. Not traveling, appearance of traveling, possible. Non-dual, appearance of duality, possible, of the same reality. So vibhati, this is the meaning. See, each word is so profound. Almost the entire philosophy of Brahman is real, the world is an appearance, and you are none other than Brahman. The entire philosophy can actually be derived from almost every word that is given here. Vibhati, vividam bhati, shines variously. The non-dual reality shines as this dualistic, pluralistic universe. The eternal reality shines as this impermanent, transient world of birth and change and death, of production and destruction. The limitless reality appears as the vast and the tiny, living and non-living. The blissful reality, that which is ananda, ever free from all trouble and ever fulfilled, appears as the ceaseless striving for fulfillment in this world. Vividam bhati appears variously. This vibhati is a direct answer to the question, what's going on here? What's all this? Vibhati. Vibhati. It shines variously. Durat suduram tadihantikecha. It is further than the furthest. For whom? For the ignorant. And it is closer than the closest. For whom? for those who realize I am that. After all, what could be closer to you than your body? What could be closer than that? The mind. What could be closer than that? You, the awareness. There's still the reflected awareness. What could be closer than the reflected awareness? You, the original awareness, that non-dual consciousness. Iha, here, in this body, in this mind, here it is. Antike, closest, in our own minds, it is shining. You are shining. Pashyatsu ihaiva nihitam guhayam. The enlightened person sees that in all beings which have experiences, which see, hear, smell, taste, touch, which have first-person experiences, which are thinking and remembering, which are enjoying and suffering, especially human beings, but all other sentient beings, in all of them, nihitam guhayam, guhayam, in the cave of the intellect, in their mind, in their intellect, there it is. It shines as awareness. Let me just read a few lines from Shankara's commentary. You'll see all of this more or less. It's like a repetition of what I just said. Brihat. It's all-pervasive, non-dual reality. Shankara says, Sarvato vyaptatva. All-pervasive. All-pervasive not only in the space sense, but also in the time sense, also in the object sense. All-pervasive in the space sense means sarva vyapi, all that is everywhere. All pervasive in the time sense means eternal. All pervasive in the object sense means non-dual. So brihat means sarvato vyaptatvat. This is Shankara's language. All pervasive. Then divyam. Divyam means, Shankaracharya says, swayam prabha. So it is self-luminous. In other words, pure consciousness. One might say, but the light is also self-luminous. It illumines everything, and it is. You don't require another light to see the light. But yes, but you require the eyes to see the light. And you require the mind to become aware of the eyes. And you require consciousness to become aware of the contents of the mind. So ultimately, it is consciousness alone, which is self-luminous. No external or internal instrument is self-luminous. Swayam prava divyam. Then it says, achintya rupam, cannot be an object of thought. Why not? Shankaracharya's language is, anindriya gocharam eva na chintaitum shakyate. It is not an object of any of the senses. Since it is not an object of any of the senses, the mind cannot objectify it. The mind objectifies that which is an object of the senses or thinks about the information provided by the senses. What is it that the mind thinks about? It's the stuff that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch. It's just, and out of that comes memories and further thoughts and understandings. And the mind thinks about those things also. But that which illumines all of the mind and the senses, that can never be an object for the mind. Then Shankaracharya says, sukshma, it's subtle. In what sense? Sukshma dakashaderapi tat sukshmataram. It is subtler than the space and the air and the fire and the water and the earth. Niratishayam hi sokshmam asya sarvakaranatvat. It is of the ultimate subtlety because it is the cause of all. The one thing by knowing which everything is known, like the clay of all the pots, like the water in all the waves and gold in all the ornaments, existence in all beings, in all things. Vibhati. I says vividham aditya chandradyakarena bhati dipyate. Vibhati, it means it blazes, you know, in the physical universe as the stars and suns and moon and all that. And then he goes on to say, further than the furthest, nearer than the nearest. He says, avidusham atyanta agamyatva tad brahma. For those who are ignorant, it is inaccessible. It's so far from the ignorant. It's right here, but you don't see it. So, somebody was looking around everywhere for their glasses, and they found the glasses were around their neck, you know? And then you suddenly discover, here it is. We thought it was far and lost, but no. It was lost and hidden only because I didn't know about it. And the moment I knew, it was revealed to me. And it was revealed to me that it was always there with me. The great commentator on Shankara's commentary on the Brahma Sutras, Vachaspati Mishra. So Vachaspati Mishra, he wrote a commentary called Bhamati on Shankaracharya's commentary on the Brahma Sutras. Vachaspati Mishra says in that commentary, Bhamati, he says that attainment can be of two types. One is Gramadesha Prapti, going to your next village. So you have to walk there or take the bullock cart or something and go to the next village. Or he says Galavalaya Prapti, to attain the necklace which is already on your neck. Now the necklace which is already on my neck, if I've forgotten it, it seems it's lost. Where did I put it? And I go all over the house looking for it. And then suddenly I realize I've been wearing it all along. So that's one kind of attainment. This kind of attainment requires knowledge. If a thing is lost due to ignorance, then it's not really lost at all. If it's gained by knowledge, then you always had it.
Yeah.
The other kind of attainment is something other than yourself, something at a distance, something to be, you know, knowledge to be acquired, place to be gone to, something, a dirty thing to be cleaned. All that requires work. But this requires knowledge alone, something that's already there. So very far from the... So is Brahman, the Atman, is it very far actually? Do you have to go on a pilgrimage to a far-off land? Or do you have to wait for a far-off time when we shall die and go to heaven? No, no, no. It is right here, right now. But only, then why don't we see it? Why don't we experience it? He says, the knowledge and ignorance. The journey is from ignorance to knowledge. It requires knowledge. So there he says, tad iha anti kecha. It's very close, right here, in this body, in this mind, right here, where we are right now, who we are right now. It requires investigation into this to suddenly get the realization, I am that. All right. Pashyatsu ihaiva nihitam guhayam. The enlightened one sees that in all sentient beings, it is shining, sparkling in their hearts, in their minds, as consciousness. Shankaracharya here says, Pashyatsu chetanavatsu ityetat nihitam sthitam darshanadi kriyavatvena yogi bhir lakshyamanam. The yogi, the jnana yogi, the one who's pursuing the path of knowledge, he notices, he or she notices that in all sentient beings, and Shankaracharya makes it clear, sentient beings means we're talking about the ones which are seeing or hearing, smelling, tasting, which are flying, slithering along, walking on four legs or two legs, whatever they are, all their sentient activities, the display of intelligence, emotion, suffering, pleasure, all these first-person experiences, the one with vision, the one with knowledge, discerns in all of them this one consciousness. That it's the play of this one consciousness. And that is called here, Pashyatsu ihaiva nihitam guhayam. Where does he discern? Where is it? He says, guhayam buddhi lakshanayam. It is reflected in the internal organ, in the intellect, in the mind, in the intellect, the awareness which we all feel, the awareness that's there in all these beings. That awareness is what we are talking about. Lakshyate vidvadvihi, Shankaracharya says. It's discerned by the those who have knowledge. I remember a monk told me very nicely, a very great master of Advaita Vedanta, Ramananda Saraswati. I heard it from him about 20 years ago in Haridwar. He said, तो सर्वत्र है अपना स्वरूप अपनी जगह ठीक है वो सर्वत्र है उसको लक्षित कैसे करें. Your nature is perfect already. You are perfect already. But how do you appreciate that? It's, you are saying it's everywhere, it's unlimited in time and space. But I'll tell you what he exactly said, then I'll explain. In Hindi he said, स्वरूप अपनी जगह ठीक है. Your nature is perfect already. लेकिन उसको उपलक्षित कैसे करें? But how do we know it? How do we discern it? Upalakshit is the word. Shankaracharya also uses the word lakshyate. You know what it actually means? It's a subtle, it's not knowing directly. It's indirectly knowing, indirectly. How is it pointed out? How do you discern it? You don't know it objectively. You can only discern it. It's a little bit like, a good example would be, I see all of you. Here, I'm seeing all of you on the screen. I can see all of you. But then that makes me discern, lakshyate, that I have eyes. Now, my eyes, I'm not seeing directly here. Directly, I'm seeing all of you. That makes me know that I have eyes. And there's no doubt that I have eyes, though I'm not seeing my eyes. Similarly, even more powerfully, how do I know I'm this limitless consciousness which makes all experience of life possible? It's by the experience of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, enjoying, suffering. All of that reveals to me I am this limitless consciousness. And very clearly, more clearly than seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, when Narendranath goes to Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna, and says, Sir, have you seen God? Sri Ramakrishna gets a direct answer, but with a curious rider. He says, Yes, I have. Direct answer. But then he adds, As I am seeing you only more clearly, as I am seeing you only more clearly. Now, I can put it in this way. I know that I have eyes with as much certainty as that you are all here. I'm seeing you. So that's certain I'm seeing you. More certain than that is my eyes. See, I am seeing all of you, but I could be mistaken. I could be mistaken. I could be mistaken that this person is maybe, this person is not there. Or that person, I'm okay. So mistaken identity, something I could be mistaken about what I am seeing. But one thing I cannot be mistaken about is the fact that I'm seeing. The object of our knowledge we can be mistaken about, but that we are having knowledge, that we are having experience, that you cannot be mistaken about. I see you as I have seen God as I see you, only more clearly. Worth thinking about. Then Shankaracharya adds, Tatrastameva avidvadvi, that means avidyaya samvritam san na lakshyate. Although it is right here, the ignorant, because it is enveloped by ignorance, the ignorant, because of their ignorance, are unable to appreciate this fact that this limitless existence consciousness is right here. Notice one thing, that we do exist. There's no doubt about it. Nobody can doubt it. That was Descartes' conclusion. It is indubitable. And does not require much philosophy, much spirituality to understand that. Everybody understands that. That I exist, who does not understand? But that I, existing I, is this limitless existence, this non-dual consciousness. That is the thing which Vedanta teaches us. How to appreciate that? The Shravana, this teaching is Shravana, hearing that you are this indubitable, cannot be doubted, you do exist, but that indubitable, cannot be doubted existence is limitless existence consciousness, the Upanishad tells us. And then we have to think about it through reasoning and see that we understand it then, what it means. And then after having understood it, stay with it in meditation till it becomes, you can say clearly it's a fact. And not only a fact, effortless fact. Then further, the benefits will start flowing from it. I'll be able to overcome the problems in my life and attain fulfillment in my life. Now, the next mantra, seventh, eighth mantra. Because it's so subtle, further than the farthest for the ignorant, and closer than the closest for the wise person, right here in this body and mind, but cannot be distinguished because it's not, you cannot objectify it with the mind. Therefore, what is the way to realize it? He is telling us once again. And here he's making the point that the real, final, the ultimate way, what the whole teaching of the Upanishad is, it can be realized through knowledge. Nothing else. All other things are useful, but it can be realized through knowledge alone. This point is being made very clear in the eighth mantra. Na chakshusha grihyate napivacha nanye devai tapasa karmanava jnana prasadena vishuddha sattva tatastutam Nice, poetic. Let me read out the translation from Swami Gambhiranandaji. It is not comprehended through the eyes, nor through speech, nor through other senses, nor is it attained through austerity or karma. Since one becomes purified in mind through the favorableness of the intellect, therefore can one see that indivisible self through meditation. Now let's consider this important. How do you see this? How do you realize this one thing by knowing which everything can be realized? This one thing which is our own reality. Na chakshusha, not by eyes. You can't see the Atman or Brahman by the eyes, with the eyes. And there, by extension, you cannot hear with the ears, you cannot smell Brahman, touch Brahman, and you cannot taste Brahman. You cannot objectify Brahman with any of the senses. And with further extension by any instrument. After all, what is a telescope? What is a microscope? It extends the range and power of our senses only. So any scientific instrument also, no, you cannot objectify the Atman or Brahman. Na chakshusha. Naapi vacha, nor by speech. So no language can express Brahman. Why can't language express Brahman? Because we have done this at other times, briefly, because language can only express something that is of a certain category or class or species, jati. It can express something that is a quality or an attribute, guna. It can express something that is a karma, an activity. It can express something, language can express something that's a relation, sambandha. Or it can express, it can just be a name given to something. Just give a name and be done with it. These are the five ways in which language operates. None of these ways can operate, reveal Brahman. Why? Because Brahman does not belong to a class or a species or a category. There's only one Brahman. There's no set of Brahmans. It's not like cows. So this animal is a cow. It belongs to the set of cows. You cannot do that. Brahman has no attribute, nirguna. Therefore, attributes will not work. Guna or attribute or quality. Brahman does not do anything. Nishkriya, no function, no activity. So how will you use language, function or activity to indicate Brahman? Brahman has no relation with anything else because Brahman is the one and non-dual. With what will it have a relation? There's no second reality. And Brahman, in order to give a name, just give a name, call it Atman Brahman, that also won't work. Because to call it something, you must point it out. This one is called Rama. This one is called Sita. Then only it works. In an audience, in a group of people, if I say, could you please call, John? You'll ask, who's John? I won't tell you. It won't work. You won't know whom you are supposed to call. So it must be pointed out. To give a name, you must point it out. But you can't point out Atman or Brahman. It's not an object in no way. By no physical way, by no conceptual way, you can't point it out. But language is the only thing that we have. Right now, Upanishad is language. And all Vedanta teachers use language. So how come you are saying that language will not work? The way that the masters in Vedanta use language is interesting. They have certain strategies to overcome this problem that language cannot reveal Brahman. The whole purpose of language is to reveal the world. The whole purpose of language is to reveal the object, but not the pure subject. I always quote Wittgenstein here, the limits of the world, the limits of my language are the limits of the world. So which is a beautiful way of saying that language and world, they are coextensive. Whatever is in the world can be named, and whatever can be named has some entity in the world in some way. Actual or figurative or whatever. But that which is, if there's anything which transcends the world, it also transcends language. In fact, Wittgenstein himself says that which is beyond the world, that we must pass over in silence. Now, what do you do? So the strategies we know, the well-known strategies are there. One is what is called the negative way. If you cannot say what it is, then at least say what it is not. Neti neti, not this, not this, not this, until you intuitively grasp what it is. Another way could be a paradoxical language. We just saw an example in the seventh mantra just now. We saw farther than the farthest, nearer than the nearest. How can it be that something is farther than the farthest and nearer than the nearest? It's contradictory. No, it's using contradictory language to point out that something is farther than the farthest because of ignorance, and the knowledge will show you it is nearer than the nearest. It's your own very self. So nearer than the nearest. But if you don't understand what it is, if you don't get it, then it's farther than the farthest. So paradoxical language can be used. Paradoxical language. Another way is to tell stories. There are stories often we use a lot, these parables are used in Vedanta. The parable of the ass which was tired, the parable of the prince who did not know he was a prince. He was brought up in a forest by a hunter, and when he was told that you are a prince, he immediately becomes a prince. Or the parable of the lion cub who was brought up with sheep and did not know it was a lion, and then it realized it was a lion. So these are parables, stories which are used to indicate the truth. That's another strategy. Then there is what is called implied meaning. Implied meaning. I will not go into it. It's those who have, we have studied the Vedanta Sara, for example. So the that thou art, tattvamasi, you are that, the great sentences which summarize the whole teaching of the Vedanta. How that is analyzed, those who have studied Vakyavritti, or if you have studied Vedanta Sara, which we have done, these texts we have done, you'll see how we used implied meaning, various kinds of implication, not direct meaning. Direct meaning doesn't work. Implied meaning. And the implied meaning has to be caught. Nanye deve, not by the other devatas. Here it means not by the other senses. So neither by the eyes, nor by speech, nor by our other senses, ears, and so on and so forth. Tapasa, nor by austerities. If you want to do fasting, you want to do pilgrimages and so many things you want to do, austerities, will that really help you to realize Brahman? No. If something is in the dark, how will you see it? You have to switch on the light. You can't sweep away the darkness, you can't pray away the darkness, you can't sing and dance and the darkness will disappear, you can't do chanting and the darkness will disappear. You can't be devoted to the darkness and pray for it to go away. None of that will work. You have to switch on the light. Similarly, he's saying here that no of the so-called other kinds of religious practices are going to work. Only knowledge. Karmanava, by any activity, by any work, can I go somewhere? Can I do some puja? Can I do some activity or good to the people, schools and hospitals, something I can do, feed the hungry, teach the uneducated, give medicine to the sick, then I'll become enlightened. Or I can do Vedic rituals which are prescribed in the Vedas, then I can become enlightened. Karmanava na, no activity will help. So summing up, not by sense organs, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, you can't attain it. Nor by speech, language cannot objectify it. Nor by any other sense organs, I mean, whatever the sense organs were mentioned. Nor by the so-called various religious practices. Nor by work, any kind of work, any effort that you make, none of them will lead you to attaining the reality. Then what will? Jnana prasadena, by the grace of knowledge, by knowledge alone. But how does that knowledge arise? You have to study the teachings. It's only with the help of the Upanishads. Study it. It should be taught by a competent teacher which is Shravana. Then you have to reason about it till you get it. Not just Upanishad told me I'm pure consciousness. What do you mean you're pure consciousness? Do you really understand it? One may feel that I've understood it, but you just face any number of philosophers who will tear apart your understanding. So it has to be proof against every possible objection. Whatever our minds come up with, whatever better minds than ours have come up with, till clarity is attained, till you'll be able to answer every possible action, every possible objection. I am limitless being, limitless awareness. So that is jnana. And then what else? At the end it says, dhyayamanaha. After shravana and manana, there must be constant meditation on this. Nididhyasana. Dhyayamana means the one who's performing non-dual meditation. Isn't that some kind of work, spiritual activity, practice, ritual? No, 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 no. It is staying with the clarity which you have got through your reasoning. Where did the reasoning come from? Not by itself. It came from the carefully listening and studying the Upanishads and the other Advaitic texts. The other Advaitic texts also teach the same thing as the Upanishads. The message must be there. It doesn't have to be literally in the Sanskrit. It doesn't have to be literally, the Upanishads only. It could be the same knowledge, but it may be through other sources also. But the non-dual knowledge has to be heard and studied. Then you get it, what has been said in the texts. Then you reason about it till every doubt is clarified as far as possible. Then what you have got and reasoned, please meditate upon it. Stay with that meditation. Put everything else aside. And he adds, Vishuddha Sattva. It requires the mind which is meditating should be a purified mind. Chitta Shuddhi should have been attained. So what will be the result? Tatastutam pashyate nishkalam. One realizes that impartite, the indivisible reality, existence, consciousness, bliss, not three aspects. Not that it's like a diamond with three facets, no. Same thing which is pure being, same thing which is pure awareness, same thing which is limitless fulfillment. Not parts. Nishkalam. A Brahman does not have internal differences that will lead to Vishishta Advaita. There is no other division, nothing other than Brahman that will lead to Dvaita, dualism. This word Nishkalam means Advaita, non-dual. Nothing other than Brahman, no other Brahman, and in Brahman also there are no parts, and no, like in the body itself, it's one body, but there are hands and feet and head and tummy, but in Brahman, there are no parts. There are three kinds of differences. Vijatiya, Sajatiya, Swagata. Vijatiya means other than this entity, there are other kinds of entities. There are dogs, but the dogs are different from cats and human beings and birds. So they, other than dogs, there are other kinds of entities. Other than Brahman, are there other kinds of things? World, human beings, and gods and demons. No, no, no. Other than Brahman, there is nothing. One. It's just like saying, other than existence, what else is there? Obviously, nothing. Because other than existence means non-existence. Then, second, Vijati, Sajatiya. Are there, all right, there's only one Brahman. There's nothing other than different from Brahman. But are there different Brahmans? Are there many gods? This idea of multiple divinities. No. Brahman is only one. There's nothing other than Brahman, and there are no other Brahmans also. Brahman is one, Ekam. All right, but within Brahman are there differences? Like in a tree, there are branches and leaves and fruits and flowers and roots. So are there differences within Brahman? The Vishishta Advaitin will say, yes, there are differences within Brahman. It is one organic unity, but there is sentient beings, there are insentient beings, Chit, Achit, Vishishta Brahma, Ataeva Vishishta Advaita. Brahman is qualified by sentient beings, billions and billions of sentient beings, and insentient matter, this entire vast material universe. They are real, distinct parts of Brahman. He says, Nishkalam, it has no parts at all. Are you crazy? Don't you see all this? Well, it's possible that one non-dual, partless Brahman can exist with this tremendous diversity of the universe. But then this diversity has to be an appearance, mithya. Real partless Brahman can coexist with a diversity, false diversity of entities, which is an appearance of entities. Real one screen can coexist with thousands of characters and thousands of places in hundreds of movies. It can still be one screen, provided that those places and characters and activities are all movie, not real. Then only the unity is maintained. So, Nishkalam, partless Brahman, Tam Pashyate, you, the enlightened one, you will realize that. Summing up, remember, when it says, not by sense or ears and eyes and all sense organs, you can't realize Brahman. You cannot realize Brahman by language. You cannot realize Brahman by and the sense organs by extension, mind also is meant. Already has said in the earlier mantra, achintya, cannot be conceived of by the mind. We cannot realize Brahman by any of the so-called religious activities, nor by any kind of secular work, karmana, by any of the motor organs, by walking and grasping and all of that, nothing. However, footnote here, be careful. All of these are necessary to become enlightened. Is it useful to have eyes and ears and hands and feet? Yes, very useful. Is it useful to know language and study and listen to talks? Yes, very useful. Is it useful to do spiritual activities like puja and havan and going on pilgrimages and taking a dip in the Ganga? Very useful. And doing service to others, feeding the hungry, educating the sick. Is it useful? Will it help? Very much so. But here he's making a point that what's the point at which you become enlightened? By knowing that one by which everything is known. That was the original question. It's a very tightly argued teaching, you know, from starting from the original question itself. And therefore, so all of these other things are preliminary disciplines and they are all useful, they all have their places, but they cannot directly reveal your real nature to you. They cannot directly show you that by knowing which everything is known. Only knowledge based on Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. Jnana Prasadena Dhyayamana specifically mentions meditation, non-dual meditation. Good. Let's look at the questions. Girish says, existence remains. The example of the book being torn apart resonates with the concept of conservation of matter. That is true. Nothing to comment. It's a good observation. Conservation of matter and energy, I would say. Vijay says, what's the difference between Dvaita and Sankhya? Dvaita just means duality. And in Vedantic concept, in Vedantic context, it means Dvaita Vedanta, the Madhva Vedanta, which talks about the difference, the five kinds of differences. Jiva Jiva Bheda, Jiva and Jagat Bheda, Jiva Ishvara Bheda, Ishvara and Jagat Bheda, and Jagat and Jagat Bheda. So the Dipancha Bheda, five kinds of differences are regarded as real. Basically common sense. So that is Dvaita Vedanta. And Sankhya, what it does is, it's also a dualistic system. You can call it a Dvaita system, but dualistic in the sense, it says everything that we experience, all objects of our experience, external, internal, all are part of Prakriti. Nature provides all of these. The external cosmos, our living bodies, our minds, everything is done by nature. What else remains then? Consciousness, which you are, which is called Purusha. But these two are separate and they interact. Where do they interact? In us. So yes, it is dualistic because it says ultimately two things are there. Not ultimately, not one thing. Ultimately two things. Prakriti, nature, and consciousness. It's a very logical system. Advaita is not so easily graspable. It's not easily intuited. It seems counterintuitive because it says whatever you see as the other is actually yourself. What you see as the limited one little being is actually unlimited. It says all that. But our basic structure of our experience, there's a subject, you are a subject and everything else is an object. You push that to an extreme, it becomes Sankhya. You systematize it, it becomes Sankhya. It is the philosophy of Kapila. Swami Vivekananda said Kapila was the first philosopher of the human race, most ancient philosophy, Sankhya. Of course, to Sankhya, we're indebted for many, many things. the concept of pure consciousness, Purusha, so many things. Sankhya cosmology. So later Vedantic philosophers borrowed heavily from Sankhya. And our whole yoga, Patanjali Yoga, is based on Sankhya, the philosophical side of it. Kunal Patel says, how can we reconcile statements below? It is said when we are completely immersed, identified with the work, we achieve excellence and perform tasks better. Yoga, karma, sukhaushalam. It is said if we identify ourselves with the work, we become the doer and thus trapped in the law of karma. No. If you identify yourself with the work, do whatever you're doing with the fullest possible attention. That Swami Vivekananda said. What is meant by identify with the work in the second statement is ignorance. We do not know who we are. It's not because we focus entirely on the work, that's why we become bound. No, no, no. It's because we do not know that we are pure consciousness. That's why we become bound. Knowing that you are pure consciousness, you throw yourself into work, do tremendous work in the world, you will not be bound. Not knowing that you are pure consciousness, stay away from all work, sit in a cave in an ashram and don't do anything, you'll still be bound. Gita, Sri Krishna says, karmanya karma ya pashyet, akarmani karma cha. Those who see in work, they see no work. Who? Enlightened one. Those who see that when the unenlightened person is saying, I will not do anything, I will stay away from all samsara, all activities, and then I'll be free, the enlightened one will see that is also work. Because until one realizes one is pure consciousness, there's no other way other than being identified with body and mind and thinking, I am doing that, and therefore getting the result of work. Of course, the way out is karma yoga, that you offer everything to the Lord as a devotional practice. That way, that's the way out. Just one point, yoga, karma, sukaushalam, that definition, yoga is skill in action. Remember, in Vedanta, skill in action means the way you can do action without being trapped in action. That is karma yoga. That is skill in action in Vedanta. Amira says, if an awakened individual gets dementia, Alzheimer's, where the mind is affected, will he or she remember that they are pure consciousness or will they forget their true existence? They won't. They won't. Once you realize what you truly are, even when the body becomes sick, even when the mind stops functioning properly because of some neurological problem in the brain, even then you're perfectly all right. Except that you may not be able to communicate, use the body anymore. Alzheimer's will affect the body. Parkinson's will affect the body. You may not be able to use the speech anymore. It will slur the speech and you will not be able to speak. I know one person, I am convinced he's an enlightened being, and he has advanced Parkinson's. And I asked him that in one of his lucid moments, internally, are you always constantly you are aware that you are pure consciousness? It's just that you can't control the body and the speech. And he said to me exactly this. Exactly, that is right. His words were, that is exactly right, he said. People think he cannot understand, he's unable to communicate. He understood a very subtle Advaitic question and gave a straight answer immediately. Why we think in this way? It seems like a very reasonable question because we think now we're getting some understanding with the help of the mind. And we think if this mind is disturbed, if I lose this understanding, if I forget, then it's gone. No, no, no. You as the pure consciousness, you are not gone. It does not even depend on the mind. The knowledge arises in the mind, removes the ignorance. Never will you be ever affected by ignorance again. John Lura says, awareness is not an object or thought, yet a thought mind is nothing but awareness. As thoughts arise in awareness and remain awareness, then nothing is, and remain awareness, then nothing is really happening. Awareness is just moving within itself. Is this true? Yes, that's a very advanced and subtle way of putting it. Even, you have to put it this way, even when everything seems to be happening, why just thought at the level of the body, at the level of the world, as that monk said, in the busy marketplace, nothing is really happening from the paramarthic, in the ultimate analysis, nothing is happening. One might say, oh, what good is the ultimate analysis? I am in the marketplace. No, in the ultimate analysis, you are being revealed. And in your real nature, nothing is happening. You are perfectly all right. Girish says, are there any modern Western philosophers' theories converging on Advaitic non-duality? Thomas Nagel, neutral monism, Al-Bahari. Al-Bahari certainly, but Al-Bahari's work is draws heavily upon Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta. So all of them, there is convergence in multiple thinkers. I would say Bernardo Kastrup, in my experience, and certainly Miri Al-Bahari, of course. Thomas Nagel's neutral monism, somewhat. I have only a vague idea of it. Cosmopsychists, not so much, but still, it's all in the right direction. That's what I will say. And you can't expect more than that. It's good that it's all in the same direction. Priya says, how about intuition? It's also in the mind, is a difficult fac different faculty that can grasp the formless. There's intuition and intuition, various kinds of intuition. There's an intuition of a doctor, an expert doctor who can immediately and intuitively grasp the disease of the patient without pathology reports. There's the intuition of an expert teacher who can understand sort of intuitively. An expert is basically who is so well versed in a particular area that develops an extraordinary capacity of intuition. So that is one kind of intuition, no doubt. In Advaita Vedanta, the original intuition is an English word. In Advaita Vedanta, the word used is brahmakara vritti, that breakthrough which enables you to grasp that you are the limitless non-dual Brahman. I am Brahman, that is grasped. That's not a thought as such. What is the role of thought in that? I would recommend Vedanta Sara. At the end of Vedanta Sara, you will find a discussion about Brahmajnana. The two terms, I'll just mention the terms without explaining them. Vritti-vyapti and phala-vyapti. What the mind can do in enlightenment and what the mind cannot do in enlightenment. What is the role of the reflected consciousness in enlightenment and what the reflected consciousness cannot do in enlightenment. What does the pure consciousness of Brahman, what role does it have in enlightenment? And how is all this different? Brahmajnana, the knowledge of Brahman, how is it different from other knowledge? There's a great difference. And so all these things are fleshed out in that discussion at the end of Vedanta Sara. Sangeeta says in Sri Ramakrishna's famous response, the questions are, have you seen God? The see is actually to see, is actually see or no. More than see, more than know. When you realize that you are Brahman, you are not actually seeing with these eyes. You're not even knowing by thinking about it, understanding it, or remembering it. It's more than that. That consciousness, because of which we are able to know and see. Just now we read Pashyatsu. In all beings which are sentient, in all their sentient activities of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, remembering, desiring, hating, enjoying, suffering, in all these activities, there's one consciousness which makes it all possible. So that one. So is it see or no? It is more than see, it is more than know. Priyanka says, most possible that more sophisticated minds might be able to grasp this reality better. Yes, it is possible. They say there is Brahmaloka. Where do you become enlightened? Obviously, the human world, our situation is supposed to be the best. But Upanishads say even better than this, Brahmaloka. In Brahmaloka, God is your teacher. So you better learn. And you have expanded capacities. All your faculties are far more powerful than they are now. And so you can become enlightened very fast. But going there is very difficult. So we better take that chance which we have right now and then realize. Then Sonali says, if we try to imagine infinity or timelessness, the mind cannot imagine, then falls silent. Then the pure consciousness that we are alone remains. It illumines this no thought state and also when thought arises again. So can we also say that it is pure experiencing? Pure experiencing, true. There is one definition of Brahman as Anubhava Matra Param Brahman. This is exactly pure experiencing. What we experience can be doubted, but the fact that we are experiencing is a, but that we are experiencing is a fact. Yes, this is a subtle but important point. It's good to hold on to this insight and follow through. Why is it that we cannot doubt that we are experiencing? What is being experienced can be doubted, but that we are experiencing, I am experiencing, cannot be doubted. Also, turn it upon yourself. I am experiencing cannot be doubted. But what is this I? I will notice that the body is also part of my experience, so it can be doubted. Even the thoughts are part of my experience. It can be doubted. Am I thinking, dreaming? Is it correct knowledge, false knowledge, real memory, or constructed false memory? Whatever it is, my understanding, all of these can be false, can be doubted. Then what is the one thing about myself which cannot be doubted? Rick says, please explain difference in definitions of Atman and Brahman. Same thing. Atman means self. And in Vedanta, the word Atman has been applied to body, senses, mind, whatever we think we are. And then when we inquire, we realize we are not the body. Therefore, body is not the Atman. We realize we are not the senses of the mind. Therefore, that internal equipment is also not the Atman. Finally, we realize this being awareness, which we are, is the Atman. So, Atman is our real nature. Who am I? The answer to that will be the Atman. Brahman is what is all this? What's the reality of all of this? It's Brahman. Literal meaning of Brahman is the vast. What we just read, Brihat, vast, limitless. And the teaching of Vedanta is, first of all, you discover what is Atman. Discover what is Brahman. And then you realize Atman and Brahman are the same thing. That's the stunning teaching of Vedanta, the final teaching of Vedanta. And that sets us free. Abhijit says, Maunam Vyakhyanam. Yes. In Dakshinamurti Stotra, it is there. Teaching is given in silence, and the ultimate reality is revealed. Why teaching is given in silence? Because actually no language can convey that teaching. It can only indirectly help us. All of these teachings, whatever we are studying, can only indirectly help us. If we immerse ourselves in this kind of thought, then slowly an understanding will develop. Then you attack that understanding with all possible, questions, whichever comes up in your mind, whichever you face in the world outside. Once clarity has been attained, I am this consciousness, this limitless consciousness. Stay with it. It's always available. Why will you not stay with it? If you are not staying with it, it means we are again slipping back into the transactional way of working, of existing in this world. Stay with it as long as possible for prolonged periods of time with focus. Oh, one more point. Purity of mind, this pure intellect has been mentioned here. Remember, it requires a sharp and subtle intellect, but more than sharp intellect, more than subtle intellect, what is required is purified intellect. Swami Bhuteshanji Maharaj used to say, Shuddha Buddhi, Shukha Buddhi na. Pure intellect is required, not a subtle intellect. Somebody may have very high IQ and still may be completely ignorant of one's real nature. And somebody may not be so sharp intellectually or so knowledgeable intellectually, not having read so many books. But with a purified mind, can grasp this truth about Atman Brahman straight away. That, yes, it is so. It's clear. There's a certain veil which moves away and it becomes clear. It can become clear to anybody. It can become clear to a child. It can become clear to a dying person at the point of death. It can become clear to a sick person. It can become clear to an uneducated person and so on. It can become clear suddenly. Shweta says, purification of mind is required to realize knowledge. Yes. And for purification of mind, all of this is required. Yes, pilgrimage, feeding the hungry, austerity. Yes. Even to live like a Jivan Mukta, we have to have a pure mind. As Ramakrishna said, whoever seen the world in a pure mind. That Ramakrishna did not say that. There's another monk who said it. But anyway, absolutely. So purification of mind, Shuddha Sattva, Vishuddha Sattva. Just now the Upanishad said, Vishuddha Sattva. Purification of mind is necessary. One of the, Sangeeta says, deeper important lessons of a seeker can perhaps learn is from the life of Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar, who is great as well as limitations of all charitable activities in reaching the ultimate. Yes. Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar, Sri Ramakrishna went and met him, had a wonderful dialogue with him, which is available But Sri Ramakrishna's analysis of him was, he's a wonderful man, highly learned, very compassionate, pure-minded, but yet that final knowledge has not, he said, Khabor, he doesn't have the knowledge of the treasure that is within himself. But he said, if he tries a little bit, he's a person who's ready. All of that compassion, knowledge, simplicity of life, the feeling for others, is it useless? No, it's very useful. It brings you very close. And yet, this Upanishad, as it says, Jnana Prasadena, it is by knowledge alone. That knowledge must arise finally. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.